Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. Our first good martini, Jim, is to point out that not only did you survive CPAC, this is a true story, you were surprised and honored to be the 2015 CPAC Conservative Journalist of the Year. Congratulations. I can't think of anyone who deserves it more.
Thank you, Greg. I was very surprised and flattered and honored by that. I think it really means something not just to get that, you know, the respect of your peers, but to get it really at the end of February for the entire year. Everybody else can just quit. Take it easy. I've already got it for the year. So good luck to everybody at 16. Now, it was really nice of them to do that. And I would say I'm humbled, but that doesn't. If you're humble, you're talking about how great you are. So I'm just going to say thanks to everybody, and we can move on to our martinis.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is still a double shot of good martini. CPAC took place from Wednesday night through Saturday, and virtually every person who's even remotely contemplated running for president in 2016 appeared at CPAC. Everyone from Jeb Bush, who got a very mixed reaction, to the adoring reaction to the folks like Rand Paul and Scott Walker and Ted Cruz to some extent. Rand Paul three-peated in the straw poll. Not sure if that means anything. A lot of folks saying this was another coming out moment to show Scott Walker as a real strong candidate in this race, Jim. And others said, especially in the mainstream press, that Jeb Bush went in, defended his unpopular positions among conservatives, and came out probably a little better than he came in. What was your general takeaway?
I think you've hit on a lot of the key points. First of all, we shouldn't be surprised by Rand Paul winning the straw poll. The CPAC straw poll victory is a old Paul family heirloom. Gets passed down from father to son. At some point, Rand Paul's kids will get to inherit that. First, Ron Paul supporters and now Rand Paul supporters are very good at bringing out their folks. And some people say, it's cheating, or you know, it's perfectly fair. Everybody's allowed to do it. That's just what they do. And Jeb Bush brought in his folks as well. And you know, every candidate tries to do that. So there's no shame in that. I don't know how accurate a measuring stick it is in terms of who the likely winner of the Republican nomination is going to be. One of the things that make it a good martini is that I think everybody did reasonably well. I don't think there was anybody who really flopped on the stage. And to be honest, if you can't give a good speech at CPAC, you really shouldn't be running for president. You know, this is not going to be a terribly hostile crowd. I think even Chris Christie did well. I think it was very smart for Christie and Jeb Bush to do a kind of a Q&A format. It seemed like they were addressing the challenges. If, you know, Laura Ingraham, who you know, and Sean Hannity were the questioners for those. There was kind of two tones to the 2 days. The first one was a very serious day. I think a lot of conservatives really feel like they were doing something important in electing a Republican Senate, kind of changing the dynamic in Washington. And, in fact, if anything, it's only liberated Obama. And they're getting a very different, you know, this is, you get Obama with no strings attached in since January, and it's been a very frustrating set of circumstances for conservatives. But the second day, I think people kind of loosened up. I think everyone understands the seriousness of the question before them, but it's always good to be around people who think alike, and who don't necessarily think alike, but who are like-minded and reassuring. I think we have a very good movement here. We have our internal battles and our squabbles and things like that, but ultimately, these are people who are passionate about making the country a better place, and you know, they have their hearts on their sleeves and wave the flag. And you know, it's always nice to be around that group, and I think that hopefully a lot of people came out of it energized with slight hangovers.
That certainly seemed to be the case. Before we get to our second good martini, you can probably tell that Jim is on the phone today. Our regular connection did not work. Jim, that net neutrality kicked in faster than anybody.
It did. I'm not kidding when I say some parts of NRO went down like 5 minutes after the vote. So they're after us.
No, it's not a conspiracy at all. Anyway, on to the second good martini. It was a little bit, it was even late last year, that we were celebrating the fact that Barbara Boxer has decided not to run for re-election in 2016. There is now another Democrat from the Senate who is expected to announce today that she is not running for another term. After 30 years, I think most conservatives can be glad that that is the decision of Barbara Mikulski of Maryland. Jim, it's Maryland. They did elect a Republican governor, so it's not impossible for Republicans to pick up that seat, but it's still an uphill climb.
As soon as I heard this news, I mean, it's not that surprising. She is getting up there in years. I immediately threw out two names, and I don't know how people will respond to those. One, obviously, is Ben Carson. There will be those who will probably suspect this is my nefarious plot to get him out of the presidential race. But I don't think many people would dispute that Ben Carson, if he were to decide to choose to run for Senate, would automatically be a serious candidate for that. He's got a heck of a fundraising base. He's got this amazing life story. A lot of Republicans have deep admiration for him. And look, he'd be an African-American Republican running for a seat in Maryland. Automatically Democrats would have to sweat about that. And if he were not persuaded, one of my favorite guys and a guy I got to speak to at CPAC, Dan Bongino, former U.S. Secret Service agent, it's really remarkable to listen to him talk about he ran for Senate before and did not succeed. And he's very blunt about the things he got wrong and the mistakes he made. Then he ran for House and came very close in a district that, let's face it, Republicans have basically had no business winning that seat, and he drastically overperformed. So a very impressive guy. Again, a very impressive life story. He's done things outside of the political arena. I'm sure there'll be other Republicans who might be looking this over, but those are the first two names that jump to mind. And I think either one of them could make it if nothing else, a more competitive race than Democrats expected to have this cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. They don't have to play a lot of defense in 2016. So anywhere where they can have to devote resources while Republicans play so much defense is definitely welcome. All right, on to the bad martini now. And Jim, it happened Friday. Most of the conservative movement was still focused on CPAC at that point. But Boris Nemtsov, a leading figure in the opposition to President Vladimir Putin, was shot dead around midnight on Friday, a short walk from Red Square. And within hours, the government had already decided it was a provocation, probably done by Chechens who are sympathetic and maybe even aligned with the West in taking out Putin's top critic. It's just mysterious how all these top Putin critics keep getting taken out by Putin's other enemies.
Claire Berlinsky, who is a foreign policy writer, she was over in Turkey for a while when I was over there, and writes over at Ricochet a great deal in other places, was writing a great deal about this weekend and kind of saying, look, I understand everybody's focused on CPAC, but this is a really big deal. And I have no doubt of it. I think this further illustrates the shamelessness and the ruthlessness and the increasing brazen tactics of Vladimir Putin. Do we know with 100% certainty that he was, killed for his opposition to Putin? No, but come on. We live in the real world here. I sympathize with her. On the other hand, there was kind of a response to the comments that I thought was kind of illustrative. I said, look, we on the right have, other than, George W. Bush at one point saying he looked into Putin's eyes, certainly since the late Bush years, since the invasion of Georgia, there's been a great deal of Putin skepticism and Putin suspicion and outright Putin opposition on the right. So those of us in conservative world aren't that surprised by this. Now, the guy's a thug. He's ex-KGB. He is a brute. And we've seen a long series of the murder of opponents of Putin and critics of his regime in Russia. This is effectively mob rule. You speak out against them, they will rub you out. So on the one hand, there's a very bad martini. On the other hand, I can understand why people aren't that surprised by that, because this is effectively Putin acting exactly like the guy we thought he was.
I think it's a good reminder, too, that oftentimes we talk about how Putin consistently gets the upper hand on President Obama on various negotiations, whether it's Syria, Iran, or something else. And so sometimes folks say, well, why can't we have a president that's more like Putin and that he can assert his will on others? Careful how far you take that analogy, because there's a lot of different aspects of Vladimir Putin that are very much like what we were fighting for half a century with the Cold War and we want nothing to do with in our system of government.
Argue about whether he's exactly the same, how similar he is to the Soviet apparatchiks and all that stuff, but ultimately he's a brute who believes the power comes from the barrel of a gun. If we want to contrary, we got to stand up to them a lot more forcefully than we have so far.
All right, on to the crazy martini now, and the big story, at least for the first part of this week in Washington, is likely to be the visit of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's addressing AIPAC, actually, as we record this, and tomorrow, of course, Tuesday, he'll be speaking to the joint session of Congress, a speech that has turned controversial. Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry, who will be overseas negotiating with the Iranians over the nuclear program yet again, was a guest of Martha Raddatz on This Week on ABC. And her question was, Susan Rice, the national security advisor, said that this was destructive. The Netanyahu visit and speech to Congress was destructive to U.S.-Israeli relations. And here's how Kerry responded to that.
We have a closer relationship with Israel right now in terms of security than at any time in history. I was reviewing the record the other day. We have intervened on Israel's behalf in the last 2 years more than a couple of hundred times in over 75 different fora in order to protect Israel. I talk to the Prime Minister regularly, including yesterday. We are not, you know, we don't want to see this turned into some great political football. Obviously, it was odd, if not unique, that we learned of it from the Speaker of the House and that an administration was not included in this process. But the administration is not seeking to politicize this.
This is very odd that he's saying that we're tighter than we've ever been with Israel when obviously there's been this huge PR pushback from the White House ever since January about this speech. And now we've got reports that a lot of people find true, even though they're not confirmed, about Obama threatening allegedly to shoot down Israeli Air Force planes if they ever attack Iran.
Yeah, I mean, that story, let's just say the sourcing was a little iffy. It's only the telephone game. There was the Israeli report of a Kuwaiti report of my brother-in-law who had once seen a guy who got a bunch of papers from Lucy Ramirez at a rodeo with the Rathergate. You know. So but the irony is that you say that. I mean, Brzezinski had said that, made that proposal a little while back, and no one would say, oh, this administration would never do that. It's like they probably wouldn't shoot down Israeli jets, right? Right? You know. What makes it crazy is Kerry's insistence that things have never been better. When in fact, I don't know if you could say they've never been worse, but certainly it seems like a low point. And, you know, when the fact that, let's assume for the sake of argument that it really was a breach of protocol and House Speaker John Boehner should have checked with the White House. So how do you react to it? I mean, you can basically say, ugh, well, we won't be attending, and Biden won't be attending, and Kerry won't be attending, and lots of Democrats, this is a giant snub of the president, and this is an insult. Or you say, no, it's all right, we didn't invite him, we didn't want to be seen as endorsing him before an election, but since he's coming here, Biden will be attending. You could just say, all right, fine, come and speak to us. But this administration isn't doing that. And so now they have to, you know, have on one hand have a de facto boycott, not just by the administration, but by lots of Democrats as well, and then turn around and insist, no, actually, everything's cool, we're fine, and in fact, this relationship has never been better. I mean, John Kerry's always been a bad liar, and one of the things that jumps out about that is that he wouldn't even, like, if you'd said, you know, we've had some bumps in the road, but we know we're in this for the long haul, that's a more plausible spin than it's never been better, which kind of suggests that he has no ability to determine what is realistic or what is plausible in the minds of the audience he's attempting to persuade, which is not a good trait in a diplomat, now is it?
No, it is not, and I don't think the administration could be confused with endorsing Netanyahu in this visit since they've lent a few operatives to the opposition over there in the final stages of this campaign.
When I was over in Turkey, I remember Erdogan, who at that point wasn't quite the nut job he has become now. There was the attitude of a lot of U.S. diplomats and the Bush administration, look, if we had to choose Turkish leaders, this is not the guy we would have chosen. But having said that, there are enough areas for common ground. They work together on the big, important stuff. Yes, they're going to pound the table and disagree very strongly with us sometimes, but this is somebody we can work with, which is not necessarily the same level as friends. That's a much more plausible designation of the relationship, that at least at the beginning of the Obama administration. Now I think it just seems increasingly clear that Obama and the administration is way tougher on Israel than they are in Iran.
And that is about as depressing, crazy, and bad as we can imagine, given Iran's track record. Jim, hope you got some rest yesterday. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.